This week on the TPM podcast, I sit down with Stephen van Bellingham, international, well-renowned keynote speaker who travels all over the world delivering talks on customer experience and the future of marketing at large. This digital space that we live in today has allowed Stephen to not only travel the world and deliver talks on these subjects, but he's also been the author of multiple books, including his best book, The Conversation Manager. Stephen and I get to touch on many topics, including work-life balance and how traveling around the world to go do a job when you have family matters at home isn't as easy as people may think. This is Stephen van Bellingham. Hey, Stephen, how are we doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Very well. Tell me a little bit about yourself and, who are you? Where do you come from? And we'll start from there.
My name is Stephen van Bellingham, and my passion is to create and share ideas about the future of customer experience. My entire career, I've been researching customer behavior linked to technology, and I write books about that. I publish articles on my site. I make videos. I make Instagram posts about that, and I give presentations all over the world about the future of customer experience.
Thanks, Stephen. So really, really interesting. What I was reading earlier is you've done over 1,000 talks now. Is that right?
Yeah, it's that's what's on my site. But I think now I'm close to 1,250 or something like that. You know, it's been crazy because before COVID, I used to travel all over the place. And then you can do maybe 3 keynote presentations a week because you have the traveling in between. Now, in the last 12 months, I've done more presentations than ever. The efficiency of doing this online is amazing. In the morning, I speak with people in the Asian markets. During the day, I talk with people in Europe. And in the evening, I work with my US clients. And you're always available. The idea of not being available for a presentation is something from a pre-COVID era. We'll see how it goes once everything is opening up again. But it's quite interesting. So I think I'm close to 1,250 keynotes right now.
How have you found that has changed the impact of delivering a keynote? I mean, clearly when you're sat in the audience and there's, you know, hundreds or maybe thousands of people at some of your talks, you know, you can get that emotion across. You can get the interaction and the feedback from the audience particularly. I know that from doing a lot of keynote speak myself. But how has that differed for you then, I suppose, doing it over things like Zoom?
Oh, everything is different. There's almost nothing the same. And in the beginning, I thought it was awful. You know, as you say, I was used to having large, beautiful event spaces with hundreds and thousands of people, and you can hear the reactions. You see the body language. You hear the applause at the end of the talk, and you give energy and you get energy back. That's what you feel on the stage. And I still remember my, March 2020, I had a calendar, I was going twice to Australia, to Malaysia, to Panama, and then all over Europe in the 3 months, let's say between April and June 2020. And then COVID came and everything was gone in just 1 week. My calendar was empty. And I thought, this is game over. This is the end. And then I think somewhere mid-April, I could give my first webinar through Zoom. And it was awful. I hated it because I was sitting there alone in my office, in our house, and I gave it my best, but it was silent. I mean, there was no sound, there was nothing. And I had no clue if I was doing a good job or a bad job. I had no clue what people's feelings were. And I remember I pushed the leave meeting button, at the end, and I was sitting there and I said, all right, that's, eat something now. Let's go to the fridge and get something to eat. And then something magical happened. I watched my phone and I had more reactions on social after a talk than ever. And then I thought, okay, people were actually listening. And then I mentally, in the weeks after that, I mentally tried to reinvent myself from, I compared it with this. I thought in the past I was like someone, an actor in a theater. Now I was someone acting in a movie, or I was like the person who's reading the news at the end of the day. I mean, these people, I watched the news then because I wanted to have all the COVID news. So I watched the news and I was like, this guy here is reading the news and it really helps me and it's high quality. And he's sitting in an empty studio himself and he's reaching out to millions of people and he's doing a great job. So I have to pretend that I'm him. And that's what I did in the first few months. And that helped me a lot. And, you know, I miss the real life audience a lot, but I'm also okay with virtual meetings today.
That's very interesting that you were able to make that change so quickly, I suppose, in your mind, because a lot of people have really suffered with this. And I think, you know, a lot of people that we speak to on this podcast are CEOs and COOs of, you know, fairly large organizations a lot of the time. And what's been quite a recurring theme is salespeople, for example, not being able to be in front of that customer, or not being able to sit in, you know, be involved in sales meetings and having to do it virtually and remotely, can't seem to grasp the change. And you're right, it already exists. These news anchors and movie stars, they're doing that exact same thing already. That's quite a change.
Yeah, it's quite a change. And it doesn't mean that you have to like it. It's just a matter of having that mindset and trying to find a metaphor of your new role and then getting into that new role. Because, I mean, if you're doing a job, you're yourself, but you're also some sort of a character that you become. Huh? When you're doing your job, there's always, I mean, if you meet me privately, I'm different than the kind of conversation that we're having now, but I'm still like the same guy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's different, but it's still close to who I am. And the role that you play in your professional life, the things that you need to do, you have to redefine that role and then figure out how you can get motivation to do that and to get results from that. And it's sometimes really tough to find that energy when you're working two-dimensionally. Mm-hmm. But then you have to look for different means. I mean, I've never been more active on social media and WhatsApp than during the lockdowns, because that was, you know, people were very receptive to talking with others and to figuring out how other people were feeling. And it was very easy at that moment to get in touch with potential clients and with clients. I think the openness to have a conversation with another human was never higher than between March and June 2020. So for the salespeople who actually were able to make that switch quite rapidly, they had a huge opportunity to make a difference.
A lot of the gatekeepers disappeared. All of a sudden, the receptionists or the assistants or whatever else, they weren't there. You know, everyone was home. They were, like you say, receptive, right? They were open to conversation.
Yeah, and they were looking for ways, how will I fill my days now that we don't have meetings anymore? Today, we cannot imagine that anymore, because now we're sick and tired of all these virtual meetings and we have way too many. But in the beginning, we were like, okay, what are we going to do today? And then someone reaches out and you think, all right, I'm going to have a conversation. So, and you're absolutely right. I never looked at it like that, but there are no gatekeepers anymore. You can reach out directly. And if you don't have their email, you have LinkedIn, you have Instagram, you have WhatsApp. I mean, there were so many opportunities to talk with others. That was a unique moment and a unique opportunity then.
So you are a very well-known, very well-respected international speaker. You know, I've seen some of what you've produced out there, the books, you know, it's absolutely fantastic. But I mean, how did you get there? You didn't just wake up at 18 years old and start speaking on international stages, surely?
No. It's my dream, actually, Sean, was when I was a teenager. And if you ask me what my dream job was, do you know what my answer was?
Go on.
I wanted to become the CEO of Disney. I'm a huge Disney fan, and it was my dream. I was telling everyone, I'm going to go to the university, I'm going to study really hard, and then I'm going to start working at Disney, and the end goal is to become CEO of Disney. So I completely failed in my mission in life if I look to my dreams as a teenager. So that, yeah, it didn't happen. And then I didn't say, okay, the alternative has to become keynote speaker. That's not how it happened. And I, you know, it's basically a number of coincidences, if I'm honest. It was only later on that it became a game plan for me. And when I was studying, I studied applied economics in Belgium, in Ghent, and I did summer courses in UC Berkeley, marketing courses. And when I was studying in my last 2 years in university, I was convinced that I would go into consulting. I was looking at companies like BCG. I was looking at McKinsey. Those kind of companies were very appealing to me. But then my professor, my marketing professor in my senior year in university, he came to me like 3 months before we graduated. And he said, look, I have this vacancy here. I'm looking for someone to do research on launching high technology products in the market. And I think you would do a great job. What do you think? And I was so flattered that I thought about it. I talked about it with my parents and I said, this is, and it was my favorite professor. So I was like, mm-hmm. this is really cool. So I just decided to jump in and take the job. And then I did research for a year and a half in a business school. And then I still remember I had the opportunity to go to an international conference, first time. It was in the US, to New Orleans. And I could present a research paper there. So I was really nervous. So I went with my professor over there. I presented. I did a so-so job, I think. And then I was planning to go back. So I was in the airport sitting there. And suddenly there's this other Belgian guy walking in front of me that I know. And he was also a marketing professor in the business school, but he also had a startup called Insights Consulting, a marketing research company in online research. And we were on a plane and the plane was half empty. And we said, let's sit together and talk. And those were still the days that you could reorder little bottles of wine in the plane. You know, there was no limit. You just did ding and you could get a new bottle. So we had a couple of those bottles and it was a very cozy flight home. And at the end of the flight, I had a new job. I worked for his startup and I said, we're going to work together. And in his startup, I had the opportunity to do research about internet. I'm talking about 2001 now, about internet mm-hmm. and how consumers used it. And I had to present, that was new internet in 2001. So I had to go all over the place to present those results of that market study. And I started to present and I became better and better at it. And I got invited more and more and more. And so I got used to it and I really enjoyed it. And then we'll make a jump of 10 years. Then suddenly I got a phone call from Microsoft. And they told me that Steve Ballmer, he was CEO of Microsoft. Mm-hmm. He would come to Belgium, to Microsoft Belgium. And they were looking for someone to give a presentation like in the pre-show of Steve Ballmer. And they invited me to give a talk there. And I thought, wow. Oh, this is a huge opportunity. So I'm going to make a whole new presentation. It has to be state of the art. So I made this presentation and the title of that presentation was The Conversation Manager. And that was about social media and how social media changed marketing communication. So I presented there. And afterwards, there was a panel debate and everyone was referring to The Conversation Manager. So my colleague, the same one from the plane, he came to me. He was there. He said, this was really awesome. Why don't you write a book about this? And it was also already one of my dreams to write a book one day. So I said, yeah, I want to write that book. So I wrote the book that year, came out, and it was a much bigger success than I ever dreamt of about. It was in Europe, it was a bestseller. It got several awards. And I ended up in that speaker environment and I became part of that world and I really enjoyed it. And for me, that was like suddenly the moment that I realized this is what I really like to do. This gives me a lot of energy. This is something I really enjoy. And then I decided 2 years later to go all in on that. And I left that company. I left Insights Consulting and decided to completely focus on becoming a keynote speaker. And I've been doing that now for 9 years. And for me, this is still a journey. I still have ambitions. I still want to grow in this profession and I still enjoy it every single day.
It's an incredible journey, an absolutely incredible journey. And, you know, really hats off to you for what you've achieved there. I will say, however, I think Bob Iger's done a great job over at Disney, however. I'm not sure you could have outdone Bob.
Oh, I'm absolutely certain that I would that this is the right choice for both me and for Disney.
Did you read Ride of a Lifetime?
I did. I loved it.
Fantastic book, right?
Yeah, I loved it. Absolutely. Yeah. I even have my own little. I'm still a big Disney fan. I still have now my little Disney bucket lists that I'm working on, and I could already, you know, scratch a few from the list. Like I had the opportunity to have a small, very small, tiny role in Cars 3 in the Dutch version. Mm-hmm. That was really cool. And by accident, by coincidence, my family and myself, we were in Hong Kong Disneyland. And we were the only non-Asian people in Main Street when the park opened up. And suddenly, you know, some of the cast members, they came to us. And they said, do you want to open the park? We have this tradition. Every day we invite guests to open the park together with Mickey. And they selected us probably because we looked strange compared to all the others. So they said, this is an attraction, these guys. So they grabbed us and suddenly we were on stage on the castle, opening up the park with Mickey and Pluto and everything. So that was a cool, that's a cool memory as well.
That's absolutely incredible. That's wonderful. That is. I mean, yeah, you're ticking off your Disney list working for sure. The book Ride of a Lifetime really was one that I couldn't put down. And I think I read it cover to cover in just a couple of days. It was one of those where I really, really got through it quickly. You know, there's a lot of talk in there on how to be a great leader and how merging technology and people and imagination, you know, works really well. From your point of view, you know, what does make a great leader in businesses nowadays?
Oh, what makes a great leader? A couple of things. And the first one is obvious, but I think you need to be able to formulate a very clear and very clear vision that creates enthusiasm internally and externally. I think that's the first thing you need to do. The second thing that great leaders can achieve is that they can translate that vision towards every individual employee of the organization. Because I've seen so many leaders that present their vision in a cool way, and it excites me very often. But when I look in the audience where the entire company is watching that talk, I often see that half or 70% of those people are like, whatever, good luck with your journey and let us do the work and you can do the crazy storytelling. So there's often a disconnect between the vision and how people feel connected to that vision. If you can translate the high level vision to what it means for every single employee, and if you can tell them how they can contribute to achieving that vision, I think that makes a huge difference. And then the third element is empathy. And empathy is probably the most important word, most important quality of a leader, that they can listen to concerns of the market, that they can listen to concerns of clients, can listen to concerns of employees, and translate that back in something that brings value to the people who shared their story. And if you have that quality, I think today you're going to be remembered as a great leader. In the past, we often thought that it was about intelligence and about strong leadership. I think today it's more about empathic leadership. And it's a quality that you don't always see. And we sometimes, I think, have a problem that some of the more famous leaders in the world of some very successful companies, we look up to those leaders, but I'm not sure if they're always, you know, the right leader for any kind of organization. I mean, I have a big respect for Steve Jobs. He changed the world. He created the most profitable company the world has ever seen. Mm-hmm. And because of that, many people believe that he was a great leader. But if you read the way that he was actually treating people, I'm not sure if that's my definition of a great leader. But a lot of people start to mimic Steve Jobs because he's so successful. And I think that's the old style leadership. I think today we need to evolve towards empathic leadership.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for EQ balancing out the IQ, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. I wrote an article recently where I think we headlined it that we deliver EQ over EBITDA, right? So we care more about the people than we care about driving the profits of the business ultimately.
Yeah, I follow that.
You're absolutely right. It's such a key, and people do mimic the likes of Jobs and some of the other leaders out there. But ultimately, I mean, again, if you've read the Walter Isaacson book, you know, Jobs was not a nice guy most of the time.
No.
And a lot of what happened, especially back then, I suppose, is a lot of leaders were, it was either admiration or fear. You either really, you believed in that Steve Jobs reality distortion field, or you were terrified of being fired. And that's kind of how those organizations were run. And I think that's just no longer the case. People have got too much choice nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely. And people want to contribute to something positive. It's in the past, you could say our vision is to grow with 30% a year and we're all going to be extremely rich. That was probably something cool in the previous century. Mm. Today, there's more than that. And young talent doesn't just want to work for a company that is making a lot of revenue. They want to work for a company that's making a difference. And of course you need revenue. I'm a big fan of growth and revenue and making money. There's nothing wrong with that. But if it's only that, then you have a problem. And it's you know, really understanding what the core of your passion is and being able to translate that to employees, translate that to customers, and use that power to create value for society. If you can combine all that, I think then you're a fantastic leader.
There's a great phrase said by Marc Andreessen, one of the famous internet investors. And it was, do you know what the difference is between a vision and a hallucination? And it's that other people can see the vision. And that translates exactly to what you was just talking about then. You could spell out your vision. You could talk to all the employees and press that you like. But if nobody else sees that, understands it, and can follow along with it, there's nothing there.
No, it's a Fata Morgana that you're creating. And you see it, but no one else sees it. It's, I love that.
So I'm really curious about some of these talks that you have done around the world. You know, we like to look at the likes of Tony Robbins and some of the, you know, the other really well-known speakers, and they all go off famously without a hitch, of course. But have you had any experiences with any talks that you've done around the world where something might not have gone quite to plan? Has there been any, I don't want to say horror stories, but perhaps something that didn't quite go as planned?
Oh, yeah. I had many. Let me share with the beginning. In the beginning, when I was giving presentations, I was mainly speaking in Belgium and the Netherlands, my home country and our neighbors. Mm-hmm. And that was cool. I still do that a lot, but my dream was always to work internationally. And then I still remember I got this first international request, and it was at a digital event in London, and they've seen me here in Belgium and they thought, oh, this is a cool story. Are you interested in coming to this event in London? And I was excited. I called my parents and I said, hey, I'm invited to speak at this event in London. This is beginning of something really big. So I took the train, came to London, came to the event space, fully prepared. And then I came into the event and then I saw, you know, it was like a big exhibition with different auditoria and stuff like that. And then I was looking for my, I asked someone, oh, where's the auditorium? And then I went to that and I looked for it. And then I saw the calendar and my name wasn't on it. And I'm like, oh my God, did I make a mistake? And I asked someone, I said, I'm a speaker, but I don't see myself here. They said, well, probably we have other stages as well. Probably you're one on the other stages. And they looked at schedule. They said, yeah, you're there in the other room. I said, oh, okay, no problem. So I went to the other room and that was like a very small room in the middle of the exhibition, no walls. And that was my room and I saw my name. And then suddenly like I hear this sound and everyone was leaving to the auditorium. And I was like, yeah, but in 10 minutes my talk starts. So what's going on here? And you know what the really embarrassing thing was? I had one person in the audience.
Oh no.
There was one... there was one person that didn't go to the big room or someone else was sharing something really exciting probably. And I was sitting there and I had this one guy in front of me and he probably didn't dare to leave because he saw the disappointment on my face. And then I decided, you know what? You never know who this guy is. He may be the most influential guy in the city right now. So I'm going to try to give the best presentation of my life. And mentally, it was very hard, but I think the guy really enjoyed it. It was very awkward, but I still remember that. And when I went home, I was so embarrassed. I was so disappointed. So sometimes you dream about something and then reality hits you. So that was a bad experience. And then, you know, once or twice in those 10 years, I lost my voice during a presentation. That's really bad if you have 500 people watching you and you feel that, yeah, that it's going to die on you. That's a really terrible feeling because you cannot explain it anymore at that moment. And I also know by now that if that happens, the voice isn't coming back for the first hour. So you just have to stop there. So, you know, all these things that can happen. But, you know, luckily in 99.9% of the cases, everything is just fluent and goes really well. But yeah, sometimes yeah, something really bad happens and you don't, yeah, you're not ready for it. And it's always really embarrassing when you're trying to give a talk and something goes wrong. It's always a bad feeling.
I suppose that just helps to build the resilience ultimately. Gives you the grit to go back and do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm very happy that between, let's say, 2000 and 2010, before I really gave official keynotes, that I spoke at so many informal events. So there were also already so many things that went wrong that I was quite prepared and I can improvise if necessary.
And I have to ask the question, but when you gave this presentation to the grand audience of one person, was there a Q&A section at the end?
There was a Q&A. We actually went to the bar and had a drink afterwards. And the guy was like, I'm so sorry for you because I really enjoyed it and it was a good story. And it was only me. So he felt so sorry for me. So we had a conversation afterwards. Yeah.
So I suppose those are pretty bad things that can, you know, negatively happen in the industry. I mean, being an international keynote speaker, I suppose you probably had what could be considered the worst thing thrown at you in terms of a pandemic and all these speaking gigs effectively cancelled or rescheduled or replanned. You know, it appears to be such a glamorous job, though. I mean, are there any other negatives to being an international speaker?
Well, it's a very nice job. I cannot see a job that I would prefer to do or that I would love more at this moment. Maybe that will change over time, but it's a very nice job because you get the opportunity to present for interesting people at beautiful locations. Financially, it's an interesting job and you get applause every day. And there's so many people who work so much harder that have to do a more difficult job that don't have all these privileges. So I'm very thankful that I can do this job. The one downside that I see is the fact that you give up a lot of your family life because of the traveling. And it's always in the evening. Very often it's in the evening or it's somewhere early in the morning. So the truth is that, you know, during the week, I hardly saw my wife and my children in the past pre-COVID. And that was not always easy. You know, some people say, oh, he's in Dubai today. That's great because in Belgium, the weather sucks and it's January and he's walking in the sun in Dubai. It must be wonderful. And that's true most of the time. But I also I had this situation once when my second son was born. And I had to leave when he was 4 weeks old for a trip to the US. And after that, I would come home for one day or half a day, and then I would go to Dubai. I still remember that. I was in Vegas for a presentation, so extremely glamorous, thousands of people, very cool place. But when I was in Vegas, I got this phone call from my wife that our little boy wasn't feeling well and that she was really worried. And the next day, I got a call that that he was in the hospital. He had issues breathing. And that it was really serious. And I can tell you, then you feel so sad and bad that you're there presenting, you know, it feels so irrelevant at that moment and not necessary for me to be there. And you're in this crazy city and you know that your son, you know, is in deep trouble and that my wife is have to take care of that all by herself. So that's a big problem. And then I was looking forward to that moment that I could fly home to Belgium, be here a day, and I had no other choice than to leave again because a lot of people were waiting for me in Dubai, and I wanted to do that. Maybe that was a wrong choice. Maybe I had to cancel it looking back, but I didn't cancel it. I wanted to do it, and I was hoping that he would be home already, and I said, you know what, I'm home one day, and that may be, but we'll discuss it back then. So I took my flight from Vegas to London, but it started to snow in London, and flight got delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed. And I was supposed to be home at, let's say, 10 in the morning, but it became 10 in the evening and the hospital was closed. Mm-hmm. I wasn't capable to visit them anymore, so I didn't see them. They were asleep. And the next morning at 5 a.m., I was leaving for Dubai. And I can tell you, when you're on that plane in Dubai towards Dubai, it's not glamorous at all. At that moment, you're like, am I taking the right decisions here? What am I doing? My wife's angry at me. Why did I make this choice? And as mentioned, maybe it was the wrong choice, but I made that call back then. And luckily, my son is now 9 and he's in perfect shape. But those are difficult moments. Huh? Those are difficult moments. And it's already difficult to miss a breakfast or to miss an important moment in school for them. But when something serious is happening and you're on a plane, I mean, you feel so lonely. That's the downside of this whole story.
It is. And it's very, very tough. And obviously, with the timeline you gave, that was quite early on, I suppose, in your speaking career and getting everything built up. And, you know, sacrifices need to be made sometimes. And it's a tough call as to where that line gets drawn.
It's very tough. It really is. And today, probably if something like that would happen, I would cancel and would look for a replacement. And I would, I always want to help clients. So I wouldn't just cancel if they don't have a solution, but I would try to find someone else that would be able to do it for me. But in all honesty, I mean, when it would be a really promising opportunity, I would still be in doubt what the best choice would be. I would still wonder, what do I need to do now? And it's always a tough choice to make. And but at the end of the day, I think you need to choose for your family. But sometimes I choose for the business opportunity. I have to be very honest in that.
It's a very tough decision. You know, early in my career, the decisions would tend to wane towards the business over the family in the early days. You know, now, many years later, like yourself, those decisions are a little bit easier now, where you can make the call on the family rather than it being a business decision. And I think one of the things that a lot of people misunderstand is they believe that, like you say, flying to Las Vegas, where it's glamorous, and Dubai and everything else, business travel is not that great. You know, pre-COVID, you know, I do 50 or 60 flights in a year. It's not fun, especially when you get caught in snow and delays and cancellations. And in your instance there, to make it 100 times worse, a very young child that's, you know, not well at all in the hospital. And it's difficult emotionally.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, but the crazy thing is, you know, we're still in a COVID phase right now when we make this recording, and I see the benefits of this life, because today and now I have breakfast and dinner every single day with my children and my family, and I enjoy that a lot, and they think it's wonderful. And my youngest son, he always misses me most. He's like, this is a win-win, Dad, because you can still do your job, you're still making money, and you see us every single day. But I miss the traveling, and I miss the real life experiences as well. So I hope I'm going to be able to go back to that, but I hope it's going to be more balanced out. And I hope that I still have the opportunity to do some virtual work and spend more time at home. And I also hope that, you know, let's say half of my time I can go to cool locations and do things in real life, because I still miss it.
And that's the interesting thing, is I joke with my team here that you know, my home address is seat 3A on the Airbus, right? Because like you say, I also miss that travel, and it's not great, but it is getting out there, seeing people, being in front of customers, being in front of, you know, partners, suppliers, whatever it might be, and having that real world experience. And it's great that, you know, I have a 4-year-old son, and it's great to be able to spend more time with him, because I'm grounded here in the UK primarily. And I've managed 2 flights this year. You know, it's been very quiet. But I talk a lot about work-life integration. People say work-life balance. I call it integration, because you know, I'm sat here in the boardroom today, and there are days when my 4-year-old son comes into the boardroom and he sits here for an hour or two whilst I'm getting caught up on some work. And, you know, once upon a time, if you had a child come in on camera on a video call, you would be saying, you know, can you not control your children, please? But now it's very normal.
It's normal. Yeah, it's part of our lives. And we made this decision 6 years ago, I think. Yeah, 6 years ago, that during school holidays in Belgium, that either I don't do any keynotes, or when I want to travel and do the keynotes, the family travels with me. So during school holidays, we're always together, the 4 of us. That's a decision we made. So during summer, that's 2 months. And if I have to travel from Barcelona to whatever place, they follow the same journey. And the rhythm is lower. So then we spend a few days in Barcelona, we spend a few days somewhere else, but we're always together. That's the promise we made to each other. And that's really, really nice to because you're always looking forward to the moment, we'll be able to spend a lot of time together. And my work rhythm is lower because, you know, events are there are not that many events during summer or during Christmas. So that gives us the opportunity to do some traveling on our own. And if we can combine that with an interesting opportunity, we do that. But it's really family time.
What has been your most interesting family stroke work combination then? Have you managed to go do a fantastic trip somewhere for the family and also had a great client talk?
Oh, what was the best one? Yeah, I remember. The best one was Tanzania. You don't get that often invited in Tanzania for a presentation, but I was lucky enough to get an invitation there from Vodafone. And a Vodafone in Tanzania is brilliant because they launched M-Pesa. M-Pesa is that mobile payment system that is huge in Africa, not just in Tanzania, but also in Kenya and in other countries. Like 80% of payments in Tanzania are done through mobile phones, thanks to M-Pesa. But it's not a financial services organization that created that. It's a telco that created that because not everyone in Tanzania has access to a bank account, but everyone has a phone. And you don't need to have a smartphone. It works on the old Nokias as well. And it's really cool because in every small village, even if there are only four houses, they have this M-Pesa loading point. So they have a complete infrastructure. And I wasn't aware of that. And I learned so much about that. And I had the opportunity to talk with them about other services that they could add. So I had this assignment in Tanzania. And it was a perfect moment. It was right in the middle of a school holiday. So we were able to do, I did a talk early on in the week, and then we could spend time in Tanzania with the family and go on safaris, and we went to Zanzibar after that. So we had a wonderful week, and it was also a wonderful, presentation, because I still remember the CEO of the company. He came to me and he said, "Stephen, I have to warn you, because the audience here is quite... silence. They don't interact that much. They will listen to you and they will be nice and friendly, but don't expect too much excitement. I just want to manage expectations." And I still remember at the end, I gave a 3-hour talk there. And at the end, they were so excited and they were so thankful. And everyone was like, having wild ideas. And I got so much energy from that. So that was a great moment. And my children were also in the room. So they were an attraction by themselves, the fact that they were there. And then we went out on safaris, and people really appreciated it that we also spent time in their country, because they're very proud of their country and the national parks. And that was a wonderful experience that we had there together.
That's wonderful. And I love being able to get the family involved in those things. It's super important to me to be able to do the same when possible. Talk to me about your YouTube channel, Stephen's Weekly. How did that come about?
About 7 years ago, I wanted to invest more in my YouTube channel. And I was looking for a format. I didn't really know what to do. So I made this weekly video where I shared an insight, but after a while I was like, okay, I'm going to be out of insights really, really soon. I can't do this forever. And then I thought, hey, why don't I, I do research every week for myself. I update my stuff. I want to be up to speed about the evolutions in the market. So I do my research, and I thought, why don't I share the results of the things that I find interesting? And then I started to play with this format, Stephen's Week. So it's a weekly video where I give in 5 to 10 minutes an update of what happened in that week in the field of customer experience, marketing, technology. And I share that weekly. And I've been doing that now for more than 5 years, every Friday, just like you with the podcast on Friday. I have my weekly video on Friday afternoon that I launch it. And in the beginning, I had a few hundred people watching it. Today, I have, depends, but on average between 8,000 and 12,000 people watching the video every week. And it's a habit that I have. Just before we recorded this podcast, I just filmed it right next to me here for this week. So it's a habit that forces me to stay up to speed. And at the same time, it gives me an opportunity to share some ideas every week with the people who are interested. And next to that, I share parts of my keynotes. I share interviews on my YouTube channel. I try to, almost every idea I have, I make a video out of it and I share it. That's basically how I use it. But it's been very important to me, because it's, if if you're in my field of giving presentations, they're the main lead generation is word of mouth. People see you somewhere and they think it's relevant and they reach out and you have a new assignment. But YouTube actually opened up a whole new world for me. A lot of people who never saw me in real life discovered me thanks to YouTube and reached out. And I really had a lot of very interesting, nice new clients thanks to that YouTube channel. So for me, it's been a really interesting journey to invest in YouTube that much.
You talked recently about the gradually then suddenly pattern.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that a little bit.
Well, you know, when new technologies pop up somewhere, you always hope that things will evolve fast, especially people like us, you and me, we're mm-hmm. in this field. We love this. The people who are listening, we're excited about it. We think, tomorrow this will become the norm. And then we're always disappointed because it goes slower than what we predicted. And you feel like technology is evolving in a gradual way. It goes very slow. But then something happens in the market and suddenly, overnight, it becomes mainstream. Yeah. We had that with the iPhone. When Steve Jobs announced that they would launch an iPhone, that was the suddenly moment for smartphones. We already had smartphones before that, but they were gradually evolving. We had the mm-hmm. BlackBerry, Nokia gave it a try, and then suddenly the iPhone came and bam, a few years later, everyone had one. That's a suddenly moment. Now, with COVID, I mean, this, in my opinion, is the biggest suddenly moment in our digital history. Look at e-commerce. It grew faster in 8 weeks than in the 10 years before that. Digital meetings exploded, online entertainment. So this was the biggest suddenly moment. And if you look at the results of studies done by McKinsey analysts, they actually made the conclusion that we jumped 7 years ahead in the future in terms of digital behavior in the 14 or 15 months of the pandemic. So it's like we stepped into a time machine, and that's a suddenly moment when suddenly without any clear reason or with a small thing that changes in the market, suddenly, bam, everyone is using it.
So what's the next suddenly that we're going to have?
I think voice assistants. Voice assistants have been around for a long time now. Mm-hmm. And I have them all from Alexa to Siri to Google. I play with them. Many people who are listening will have them, but until now, for me, they feel like a gimmick. If you want to know what the weather is going to be, you ask them for a song and their kitchen timer. And that's basically it for most people. So it's fun, but it's not life changing. The moment when we're going to have the iPhone after the BlackBerry moment for voice assistants, when we have an Alexa 2.0, when we have a Google Assistant 2.0 that really works, that's going to be the suddenly moment in that world. And, you know, if you talk with AI experts, that will probably happen between 2 and 4 years from now. And I'm very much looking forward to that.
I agree with you. There's still just too much friction. Yep. That's the problem. Having to remember to say Alexa and Siri and whatever. There's too much friction point there. And until it becomes native and embedded in what we do every day, you know, I travel an awful lot, and I've got to the point where most times I don't take my laptop anymore. I just work purely off an iPhone.
Yeah.
But I'm still typing away. Yeah. And I could use the dictation, but it's not quite there yet. And it's there's still enough. Problems.
Yeah. It's not good enough. And then, I mean, you're living in the UK, your native language is English. When people in my country try to speak to Alexa and Google and we have an accent, they don't always understand us. And they have a version in Dutch, which is my native language. But the amount of content that they have in Dutch is so much lower than in English that you're switching back to English. So it's for non-English speaking people in the world, the challenge is even higher with all these systems. But I'm with you. I imagine that we can just talk to our iPhone and that we don't have to type. I mean, the interface of a keyboard, just look at it. It's like something from the Middle Ages. They invented this in the 1960s, and we're still using it today in the exact same way. It's incredible. We should get rid of it in the next few years.
Well, that's interesting about getting rid of it in the next few years. I mean, how does that then relate to, you know, not just our home usage, but customers as well, right? There's a clear relationship between where technology is going and how the customer interacts with technology. And like you said, you've seen it in e-commerce, you've seen it in all these different elements. We've got companies like IKEA, I suppose, that are trying to do some of the virtual reality stuff, put the furniture in your home and that be part of the customer experience. But I suppose, how does that move forward in a way that is good for the customer? What is the next big leap for that customer?
Well, if you look to digital, digital interfaces will become more invisible. They will become more personalized. They will require less and less efforts, and they will become more and more proactive. I think those are the four dimensions of the interface of the future. And in many cases, we're close to that. I think that if you look to the past decade between 2010 and 2020, you could positively differentiate you or your business thanks to digital convenience. That's how companies like Uber and Amazon became really big, because their convenience levels were just outperforming the other players in the market. Today, especially after the big digital jump forward from COVID, people understand what works well and doesn't work well, which means that digital convenience has become a commodity. If you have it as an organization, fine, but the customer thinks it's the most natural thing in the world. It becomes a negative differentiator if you don't have it. So it's hard to positively differentiate yourself with. So I think that the challenge in customer relations will be found on a higher level, where you try to become what I call a partner in life of your customers, where you try to really have a deep understanding of what your customers want. And here it's not about optimizing your customer journey. It's about bringing value in the life journey of customers. Here it's about bringing positive change in the life of your customers. That's a different mindset. You need empathy for that. You need to understand what people really value. And then it's a matter of creating that value. And you're going to need to have an in-depth understanding of your customers. So data is going to be a crucial part of that. But that's not going to be enough. Having the capability to combine the data with an empathic understanding of your customer, so the human component, that will allow you to bring services to the market that, you know, increase the value in the customer's life, and you become a partner in life. It's like when you have a gym, it's not about having all these facilities where people can work out on. It's about becoming a partner of a healthy lifestyle. When you rent out student apartments, it's not about, you know, just renting out a safe and clean place. It's about being a partner in a successful start of their career. And if you understand that and you can bring that to them with certain services and with a lot of empathy, thanks to the deep understanding that you have, I think that's the new frontier. I think that's where you will be able to make a difference. So it's going to be that combination of technology with the human empathy that will, you know, enable that. That's how I see positive differentiation towards customers in the next few years.
That's really interesting. I mean, that's really just having skin in the game and investing in a relationship with your customer, not just taking them for granted. And I think we've seen a lot of retailers, especially during the pandemic, just assume that the consumer is there, the customer is there for granted. We open our doors and people are going to walk in.
Yeah.
And now all the doors have had to close. There's been no one walking in. And sure. It's only those brands that have invested in having a relationship with their customer. And that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's somewhere ready. Yeah? And it's amazing to see that even when a real shock like COVID hits the planet, that you still have retailers that don't see the urgency and that still believe once this thing is over, we're going to go back to normal. And of course, we're not going to stay in this strange COVID behavior, but we're not going to go back to as it was. No. I was talking with a producer of movies in Belgium this morning, and we were talking about movie theaters. When I was a student, I don't know how it was with you, but when I was a student, we had this habit of going to the movie theaters every week. Maybe on Thursday night, and we walked to the movie theater. We didn't know which movie to take. We just walked in. We looked at the posters and we said, okay, we're going to go to this movie. And then we went in, and afterwards we went out and had some beers together. That happened every week. If you look to young people today, young students, my children, your children, they're so used to these streaming platforms. They have access to Netflix. They have access to Disney Plus. They have YouTube. There's so much content out there that I'm convinced that they won't just create this habit of going to the movie theater every week. They will go to the movie theater when it's something really special, when it's something really important, maybe when there's a really big new movie and they want to go. But just walking in and then deciding on the spot which movie they will go in and watch, that won't happen. That will never happen again. So when movie theaters open up again, Hollywood is going to launch blockbuster after blockbuster after blockbuster. But once we go back to the normal rhythm, I'm very curious to see what the visit numbers will be after that. And I don't think that they will come back to as they were unless movie theaters reinvent themselves and understand that they will have to do something differently than what they've done in the past, because people won't just come in as they used to.
I think you have it exactly right. They have to reinvent the movie theater experience because, like you just mentioned there, you and I would go and it would be, you have to turn your phone off, you have to sit, you have to do, you know, all these things. Now the experience of watching something is very much, it's a two screen experience. You're watching something on the TV and you're communicating via the phone about what you're watching a lot of the time.
True.
And you know, I'm quite big on education and being really clued into to promoting better experiences at home as well. And so I have no televisions in my house.
Wow.
Haven't done for the last 2 years. I have an iPad and I have these, you know, other devices. But with my son being 4 years old, he gets the occasional use of an iPad to watch a Disney Plus or whatever it might be. And it was only yesterday he was watching something on YouTube for kids. And he was, "Daddy, I think it's broken." I was, "Okay, I'll go over and have a look." And there was an advert. There was, you know, an interstitial ad in the middle of the video. "Daddy, it's broken."
And I think
we're going to see interesting things happen in the movie theaters where people will intend, I mean, they already do, but it's going to be even more so with the next generation, turning into their 20, 30 minutes late to skip all those trailers and ads at the start of the movie. You know, there's no social element to the movie theaters right now, and that's what everyone's enjoying with streaming platforms.
True.
So it's a complete reinvention. It really is.
It is. Today we want to have live experiences, social engagement. It's shared. Everything is shared and more creative. Huh? And I mean, going to the movie theater today is the same experience as when I went to the movie theaters 30 years ago.
Slightly bigger screen, slightly better audio. Other than that, it's the same experience.
More snacks, easier to get snacks. But next to that, same experience.
And the friction hunting mindset? I mean, that comes into all of it, right?
It's a friction hunting mindset. It's really understanding that if you create frictions for people that, yeah, they don't like it and they're going to look for an alternative. Huh? And it's basically, or let me turn it around. If you look at it from a customer point of view, what is the scarcest resource that people have?
Well, I'd say time.
Time is the scarcest resource people have. So if you create frictions in your communication, in your ordering process, whatever, you're basically wasting people's time. You're wasting their most valuable asset that they have, and you're not respectful to their time. And that's why people hate friction so much. And that's why I invite every organization to become a friction hunter, to make sure that as many employees as possible become friction hunters, where you're sensitive for little things that you do wrong, little things where you create friction, little things where you waste people's time. And if you're sensitive for that and you can identify all the little frictions, usually the truth is that they're very easy to solve. Usually they're quick wins. They don't require a lot of budget or a lot of time investment to solve it, but we simply do not see it anymore. It's like when you move into a new house and you've been working really hard to renovate it and everything, but like one room is still not finished. Everyone has this one room that is not finished. And after a while, you don't see it anymore. It's just part of your house. But then when friends come in, they're like, "Why didn't you finish this room?" "Oh yeah, that's right. I didn't finish it." You don't see it anymore. And it's the same with organizations. You don't see the crazy things anymore that you created for customers. So when you become a friction hunter, you look at the entire process from a customer point of view. You walk through that entire process from a customer point of view, and you will say, why the hell did we do it like this? This is a friction. Let's remove it. And by creating that mindset, you create a lot of value for people, especially because it will show them that you value and respect their time.
That's really good. I have a huge interest in time management just because of all the balls and plates that I have to spin, right? So do you do anything particular in terms of time management or managing, or how you manage, I suppose, such a busy schedule?
I'm like you. I'm an extremist in terms of time management. Most people find it scary how I work with time. I'm an extreme planner. Everything I need to do is being planned. And I have this promise with myself that once it's planned, I will execute it as it is planned. And that's what I do. And I hardly ever change that. Of course, I'm flexible if I need to work with things. But when I wake up in the morning, I perfectly know what my day will look like. And I just execute the plan as I made the plan. And that gives me a comforting feeling, because then I know I have enough time to do all the things that I need to do. And if I don't make a very detailed schedule like that every single day, it makes me very, very nervous. I always have the feeling that I don't have enough time.
Yeah, I think I'm very fortunate that I have an assistant that helps out with that. But also, I am very diligent in time blocking. That's one of the things I follow quite astutely. And it is from work to personal to life to everything. And it has to be in there.
Yeah, me too.
The saying at home with my partner is, if it's not on the calendar, it doesn't happen. And yeah. Within reason, almost everything is calendared.
Yeah, same here. Exactly like that. If I like to take early morning walks just to reflect and think about all the things that I'm working on, and I put it in my calendar. And if it's not in my calendar, I don't go for a walk. It's like, this is going to sound really strange for other people who are listening in, but it only happens when I plan it in the calendar.
I think our calendars would be scary to most people, I think.
Yeah, I think we sound really, really, really weird for most of the listeners right now.
So you're 10 years into this journey, you know, well over 1,000 fantastic international talks. At what point would you consider yourself to have been successful in your career?
Oh, I have the feeling that I'm successful in what I do. I achieved more than what I hoped I would in this profession. So I'm very happy. If it ends here, I'm going to be very happy, which doesn't mean that I don't have any more plans or any higher ambitions. My end goal that I will never achieve is that I want to be seen as the reference in the world in terms of customer experience. And if you have a problem anywhere in the world, that first name that comes to mind is my name. That's my end goal. That's what I'm working for and what motivates me to keep on going. And everything I do, every keynote I do, every video I make, for me, that is an investment to reach that goal. And every soul I can convince along the way is a step closer to that goal. But I see it more as a journey than as something that I eventually need to achieve. It's a direction that I created for myself, a direction that I follow. I know where the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is, but I'm very convinced that I will never see that pot of gold. But the journey towards it is really exciting for me.
No, I think we share the same thought process. I'm going to have to ask you, just based on some of the books, obviously, that you've produced and some of the things that you talk about, but I want to get your take quickly on cryptocurrencies and where you see that area growing or not, perhaps.
Cryptocurrencies will play a huge role in customer experience and in society in general in the next couple of years. Until now, if we talk about Bitcoin or Ether, a lot of people instantly think about criminals, drug dealers, and all kind of crazy people that, you know, do stuff that is bad for the world. Mm-hmm. So they have quite a bad reputation among many, many people out there. But I think we're at a turning point right now. I think this year is very interesting. We have the hype in NFTs, non-fungible tokens. Suddenly everyone knows what it is, and suddenly you can buy a digital asset exclusively for yourself, and you are the sole owner of a digital asset. This is something new. Another movement that I see is personal coins. I had the pleasure to be one of the first 100 users of Rally.io. And Rally.io is one of those platforms that creates personal coins for content creators that want to create their own economy. And yeah, this is a coin I made. It's called CXM from Customer Experience Management. I didn't use my own name. I didn't want it to be about me. I want it to be about the industry that I'm in and the domain that I enjoy so much. And I created it, but everyone who's listening can go to rally.io and they can start to play with the coin that I created and do their own, you know, events with and use it to create or support their own content. And this sounds very abstract, both NFTs and personal coins for many people. But if I translate this to what it could mean to customer experience, I think that every organization that has a large fan base, that has a community of loyal customers or loyal fans, those kind of businesses will be able to use them in a way to change the engagement. About Ed Sheeran or Beyonce. Imagine that they have their own coin. And if you, you know, buy some of those coins and you could use that for selective and premium experiences, they can create their own economy with that. Mm-hmm. Think about Nike. Maybe you could have a Nike currency that gives you access to certain services. Think about soccer teams. What if a soccer team owns this digital currency that you can use for you know, special occasions, or that you could use in the stadium to get a beer that you don't need your real money, but you pay with your currency, and you get free currencies back from the soccer team if you support them on social media, for instance. Or if you look to me, imagine that I've been doing this quite a bit now. If you share my content, my videos, I give you a coin. I give you a CXM coin. You get it for free from me, and it is a certain value. Imagine that you do that 10 times, and then next year a new book comes out for me. I can say, hey, you can buy it in the bookstore, but you can also get it if you send me 10 CXM coins. So the most loyal people that were sharing my videos actually then get the book for free because they were supporting me in the first place. I'm not doing it like this yet, but these are like the fan engagement kind of evolutions that I see in the field of cryptocurrencies. And this is completely different than Bitcoin. This is more commercial usage. This is more fan engagement that you can create with them with that. And I'm convinced by 2030, everyone who's creating content, and then I'm talking about artists, I'm talking about soccer teams, I'm talking about people on YouTube, on Clubhouse, all of them will probably have their own coin and their own economy that they play with, and it will be seen as the most natural thing in the world. And if you look at it in a more, let's say, macro geopolitical environment, what I feel is really important these days is central bank digital currencies, where, you know, the central banks, we know central banks as those guys that print more money when we have a situation going on with the economy, mm-hmm. then these guys print more money. But what if they now create their own digital currency? And the first huge country that will start doing that is China. They have the yuan, and they will create a digital version of it. They're going to be the first big central bank that has a digital currency. They're going to have that. They're going to launch that later this year. And their goal, from a, you know, strategic point of view, is to create an alternative for the US dollar, because the US dollar is now the biggest reserve currency in the world, and it gives a lot of power to the United States in terms of, you know, relationships with countries, or if they want to sanction certain countries. They have a lot of power because of the US dollar. What if China creates the first digital currency that is accepted worldwide as an alternative? And what if they force all the countries that they work with on their new Silk Road, from China to Europe to Africa, to work with that coin to do business with them? Then suddenly the reserve coin could become this digital yuan. And of course, the US will never let that happen. So there's a big chance that in 2022 or 2023, the US Federal Reserve will have a digital US dollar. And then it's something completely different. Then the crazy thing that started, like Bitcoin for drug dealers, is now something that is being created by central banks. And you can imagine that this will create a whole new dimension in the world of financial services. So I'm convinced that this will play a crucial role in the world in the next couple of years on multiple dimensions.
I really like what you said there about content creators, particularly when we're recording this. I think it was only earlier this week, Jack Dorsey, the co-founder of Twitter, his other company Square, just bought this week Tidal, the music streaming service.
Yeah.
And obviously Square is making a huge push in cryptocurrency as well right now. So the sort of arrangement they've talked about there is being able to pay artists and contributors more fairly and in different ways. And I think what you're seeing there is really between what Square's doing and what obviously Elon's done with Tesla, where he put, what was it, $1.5 billion in crypto, you're seeing some of these big players make that push now. Mm-hmm. That's going to start to trickle down the chain, I think. And what you talked about there with China is immensely interesting, because that just creates competition very, very quickly and very fiercely as well.
Yeah, so absolutely.
It's an interesting future. The NFTs, I still can't get my head around that. I still can't appreciate. I think someone bought Jack Dorsey's first tweet for $2.5 million.
Crazy.
I can take a screenshot of the same thing. I don't get where the value is right now, but I guess that's the difference between owning an original Van Gogh and a print.
That's it. I mean, there's only one owner of the Mona Lisa. It's in the Louvre in Paris, but I can go there and take a picture, or I can go to the souvenir store in the Louvre where they're going to send me a replica for €2.5. But there's only one real one, and there's only one owner, and we can all watch the real Mona Lisa, but we're not taking it home. And it's basically the same with NFTs today. But it's very abstract for a lot of people, and it's still early days. I can truly imagine that 10 years from now, that it's going to be totally normal to get certain assets, certain pieces of art, digital art, and that you think it's the most natural thing that you pay for them and that you're the owner. And what I really like about NFTs is, imagine that you are an artist, a digital artist. Today, everything you make is stolen on the internet and is used for free. Mm-hmm. Now, you create this one piece of magnificent art, I buy it from you, and in the code, we can say every time that I sell it, you get 20% of that fee. So imagine that would have happened with all the big painters from, you know, the last 100 years of the last century. They sold it very cheaply, and then suddenly it becomes expensive 100 years later. Imagine the heritage that if you are a grandchild of you know, I don't know, a famous painter, European painter, that you still get 20% every time it's sold for millions and millions. And I like the fact that the original creator still benefits from the increase in value along the way. And that's something that you only have with NFTs, because it's programmed in the code when you sell it, that you cannot change it. It's an agreement you made in the beginning. And for the rest of our lifetime, that will happen.
I think it's going to be a whole new way of trust funds being topped up over the centuries.
Absolutely. Yeah, I fully agree.
All right, Stephen, this has been a great chat. I've really thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you ever so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me. And it's been wonderful to be your guest.